From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. OSU graduate and recent NEA grant recipient Maggie Smith is a featured author at the May 7th Ohioana Book Festival, along with plenty of other great Ohio authors. More information is available at www.ohioana.org. I talked to Maggie Smith recently about poetry, writing, and why she prefers not to rhyme. Maggie Smith was born in Columbus, Ohio, and earned degrees at Ohio Wesleyan University and The Ohio State University. Her poems have appeared in The Paris Review, The Gettysburg Review, and The Florida Review. She won the 2004 Pudding House National Poetry Chapbook Competition for Nesting Dolls, and her collection Lamp of the Body won the Benjamin Saltzman Poetry Award. She is a 2011 recipient of a Creative Writing Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts for her most recent collection, The Manuscript in Preparation, named Hush Now. Welcome to Writer's Talk, Maggie Smith.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start off. How did you win the Creative Writing Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts?
That's a really good question. Okay. I wish I could answer it. I'm not sure exactly how this happened. It seems like a really sort of shocking and wonderful thing. But basically, you submit 10 pages of poems and some background information, and you send it to the NEA. And they have national panelists in poetry who read and rate the manuscripts. Yeah. So it's just based on the quality of the work. They don't see a resume. They don't know if you've published a book before or haven't even published a poem in a magazine. Mm-hmm. And it's anonymous. So in that way, it's kind of nice because it's a really objective process so that someone like me who, you know, has one book and a couple of chapbooks is competing against people who have 10 collections of poetry and also people who have maybe published a couple of poems in journals. And actually, I think you have to have at least published one book or I think it's 20 poems in national journals. So it helps weed out some like really, really beginning writers, but that leaves a lot of room open for, you know, Pulitzer Prize winners and people like me who haven't quite gotten there yet.
Well, that's next prize is the Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, yeah, that's next
that's
on my list.
Next year, okay. How did you choose the poems for that? How do you go through your selection and say, these are the ones
these
that
are
I
the
really
ones? You know, I really wanted to try sending my most recent work because it seemed like, well, let's just kind of test it out. And a lot of them had been placed in journals that I really respected. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, if those editors thought that these poems were good, then maybe they've got half a chance. But to be honest, I mean, it's really hard to pick 10 poems out of your whole body of work. And I just remember just sort of crossing my fingers and choosing the ones that I liked best and that I thought kind of worked well together and kind of told a story rather than being just my 10 best. Mm-hmm. And sent them off and crossed my fingers and kind of forgot all about it because when you apply for one of those, at least for me, I never expected to actually win it. It's just something that you do because it doesn't cost you anything. And of course, that's what you're supposed to be doing.
Writing. You're supposed to be entering
you're
contests.
You're supposed to be entering contests.
That's it, yeah.
And it just seemed like the, you know, that's what you do. So I thought, well, let's just do it and see what happens. And I got a call on my cell phone on election night from a DC area code. And I thought, well, it's probably one of those recorded congressperson, you know, responses telling you to get out to the polls, and I'd already voted, and so I didn't pick up my phone, and then it rang again, and it ended up being someone from the NEA telling me that I had won this fellowship.
That's a much better ending to the story than if you yelled at them to stop calling you.
Right, and then
already voted, hanging up on them. Right. Well,
it could have been worse.
Yeah. So you were one of 42. From over 1,000 applicants.
That's right.
So now you can go out and find these other people and, you know, lord it over them, the Pulitzer Prize winners. Things like that. And Suzanne Jaffe from the Thurber House in Columbus commented that, quote, your remarkable talent assures you a place in the literary pantheon of memorable Ohio authors.
Wow.
So who else is in this pantheon and what does it look like since you're there now?
It's huge. Okay. I mean, if you think, I mean, my favorite Ohio writer is James Wright, a poet from Martins Ferry. And to think that anyone would put me in a category with the great Ohio writers, I mean, obviously, James Thurber is, you know, the person that Suzanne is promoting on a daily basis. And it's just amazing to think. I mean, Rita Dove is from here. There are so many amazing poets who are either from here or who live here now and call it home. I think Ohio has more colleges and universities per capita than any other place in the United States. So there are a lot of wonderful poets living and working here, and a lot of whom teach here. So I think, to be the poet from Ohio this year it just floored me. Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
Well, let's go back to that. You went to two different schools in Ohio, both to Ohio Wesleyan and the Ohio State University. The Ohio State is where you got your MFA.
That's right.
Tell me about what happened to you as you were going through college. If, you're postulating that it's all the colleges and universities that are sort of helping to stoke the fires of poetry and writing in Ohio. What happened to you when you got your MFA? How did that change you?
Well, I mean, I don't know that it changed me, although it gave me 3 years to really only have to focus on writing and editing and teaching, which for me was such a luxury, because I going through college, you take a lot of different classes and a lot of different subjects. And so while I was writing, I was never really able to just focus on poetry. And I took some time off after college to work. And so again, I was working and not really able to focus just on poetry. And the MFA was wonderful because it really gave me a sort of 3-year grace period, mm-hmm. to take a time out and sort of prove to myself that I could really do it and at that level, because I wasn't sure. I mean, when I left college, I really wanted to be a writer, but I wasn't really sure I could be a writer. And while my professors were very supportive, a lot of them said, look, it's really hard. The competition is tough and, apply to MFA programs, but there's a chance you won't get in. And it doesn't mean that you can't be a writer. That's just one path, but just be prepared for it. So I was thrilled to be able to go. I was thrilled that I was able to stay close to home. Mm-hmm. And
you'd also been accepted at Washington.
Washington, right? And Arizona. And those were the two places that it was really tough. And I was kind of narrowing it down. But in the end, I decided to stay close to home, and I've never regretted the decision. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it was great. I mean, getting to work with people like Andrew Hudgens and Kathy Fagan and David Citino really helped my work, because you need other people and also your fellow graduate students looking at your work and saying, okay, I see what you're doing here, but I don't understand. And that workshop process was really useful for me for 3 years.
Do you still do engage in a workshop process? Are you with other people in a writing group? Is that something you...
I'm not. Not in a traditional way, but I do have, 3 or 4 friends from graduate school that I email poems back and forth with. They'll send me a poem and say, okay, this is as far as I can get it. What do you think? Is it done? Is it not done? Rearrange it. Tell me what you like. Tell me what you don't like. And we'll just, put on the, track changes and rearrange each other's work and email it back and say, okay,
if so you rearrange each other's
work. We really
work,
do. Right? And I don't know that that's a typical process. I know a lot of people who have a more traditional workshop process where they just sort of write comments and suggestions. Mm-hmm. I think because most of the people that I swap work with are working full time, and some of them have children and they're very busy, and it's just, we don't really have time for the phone conversations and the sort of back and forth email that would require.
So it's an abbreviated.
It's an abbreviated version. It's here's what I would do with it if it were mine. And when you get a few of those back from a few different people, and they're all slightly different because they have different points of view, it's nice because I say, okay, well, this doesn't really fit my vision for the poem, but I love what this person has done with this stanza, or I love that this person didn't think it had to be in stanzas. It should actually just be one long chunk of text. And that's been really useful. So I've continued to do that since leaving Ohio State. And just this week, I was swapping poems with a former Ohio State colleague of mine. So
that's really interesting, because it brings up the notion of collaborative authorship. And, where is it your poem? When does it become somebody else's?
Yeah.
Is it, if they're just messing with the messing, if they're
tinkering.
changing the structure of it, is that then not sort of a co-authorship? But for you, obviously not. It's your phrasing, it's your words, and that's what's you're keeping there, even if they moved it or changed the form in some way.
Right. I mean, sometimes it'll be, I don't think that's the last line. I actually like this line from the middle better as the last line. Mm-hmm. And that can totally change a poem in a way that you never would have thought that it could happen, but it's still your words, and it's still something that would have come out of a workshop conversation. It's just we tend to do the abbreviated version of it.
So you get really good at it in grad school, and then you can just abbreviate it later on.
Well, I think, honestly, if we all lived in the same place, we would probably have a workshop. But we've all sort of scattered to the wind, and some of them are teaching at universities out of state, and, mm-hmm. and we're all in separate places. So it's just sort of easier to do it that way, I guess.
And you've said poetry tends to come third in your life after your family and editing textbooks for elementary school students. And I was an editor for a little while, and it's a very, very different kind of mindset than being a writer. And you also write in short bursts while doing other things. And I'm interested in how you knit together these ideas that you write down in notebooks that apparently you carry with you everywhere. How does that come together for you? How do you say, here are a bunch of different things that I've written that, for all I can tell, may or may not be
related?
Yeah. How do they become related when you write a poem?
Well, I mean, I think for me, I tend to obsess about the same kinds of themes and ideas for a long period of time. And so even if, you know, a bunch of fragments were written over 6 months, there's a good chance that over those 6 months, I've still got the same issues percolating in my brain. So they're probably related thematically, even if maybe the voice doesn't quite sound the same or the line length wouldn't quite be the same. Mm-hmm. So that kind of helps. I really do tend to be sort of tenacious about ideas. So once I get something in my head, you know, like the fairy tale project or, you know, what I'm working on right now, which is sort of based on disaster and sort of 21st century, what is the future going to be,
especially good time poetry.
Really feel good, lighthearted verse.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Those things tend to kind of stick in my mind. So anything I write down or see or think of, it's hard for it not to be through the lens of whatever sort of project I've got going on at the moment. And then I'll sort of take some time, usually on the couch late at night, in between loads of laundry, to drag out my notebooks and start copying all these different things onto a single sheet, or some, you know, sometimes keying it in on my laptop, and just kind of seeing, okay, are any of the same images coming up here? What is the, you know, what's the concern? What's the issue? What is the speaker worried about or afraid of, or, you know, urgently trying to say? And I find that more often than not, I'm able to combine maybe not everything into one, you know, potluck poem, but I'm able to take at least a few sections and recombine them into maybe three groups and then put those away. And then I can come back and start shaping those into individual poems.
Okay. Well, you know, I wondered about that. I had a question about in your collection, Lamp of the Body.
Yeah.
You seem to be, there's this recurring imagery about cigarette smoking, being in pajamas. It seems like maybe you were dealing with the illness of a smoker or something along those lines. And
I
wondered if
I was not smoking in pajamas while I was writing.
Which would be bad, right?
No.
Yeah. So, but a number of these poems deal with it, and there was one in particular that I wanted to ask you about that deals with. I think maybe I've figured it out, and maybe I haven't. I also think maybe I've lost the page. But the coming back to the same sort of imagery all the time that says that you're really working through a lot of the problems, as you said, and the issues. I mean, you can go to one of the poems called First Spring, actually deals with some of the issues, but hang on just a second. Sorry, I thought I had this. Stella by Starlight.
Oh, yeah.
And you say, well, if you'd like to, I don't know if you'd like
I'll
to read
it
that.
If
you'll
you'd
read
like.
That better than I.
Well, I don't know about that, but I'll give it a shot. Stella by Starlight. She's waiting for us inside. Someone's name is on the tip of her tongue. She calls my cousin the girl and my cousin's son the baby. Today the girl brought the baby. Night comes on, a blue wash, cadet blue. The rain is nearly invisible. She's waiting inside, convinced the sofa has been reupholstered again in what proves to be the same damask, worn and blue, she's had 30 years. Lucid moments are cruelest. She asks me where I've been, and then she's gone, calling her cigarette knife, grinding out her knife in the pewter ashtray, shaped like a seashell. Her blue house slippers are embroidered with pink roses, green leaves. Her hair is set. Her heart is an instrumental on the old radio. She hums the melody. It's a song, and the name is.
And then that's the name of the poem.
Yeah, the name of the poem is Stella by Starlight, but she doesn't know the title that she's humming. I mean, a lot of this book was written, this was basically my master's thesis. This was my MFA thesis that I spent a little bit of time after graduating revising, and then I sent it out that fall after I graduated to presses, and Red Hen took it. So this is pretty much what I spent 3 years of my life doing. And during the first year of that process, my grandmother, my mom's mom, was very ill with both cancer and Alzheimer's at the same time. And this poem is sort of directly out of spending that much time with her, who was a smoker. Mm-hmm. And so with hospice being there and me having that sort of flexible graduate student schedule, I was able to spend more time with her than I would have been if had I worked a full-time job at that time. And so the issue of memory and seeing and trying to capture things and remember them and write them down and keep them out of fear of losing them someday really permeates almost all of the poems, I think, in this book.
Yeah, I mean, it struck me as one of these really ambiguous moments, because you say lucid moments are the cruelest.
Yep.
Because you're writing these things down, but they're also fairly depressing.
They're painful.
Painful.
Yeah, I mean, wanting to remember something is sort of a double-edged sword, because it's not always the kind things that you remember, but you have to remember them anyway. And in the case of that line, it also refers to the fact that when she was lucid, she knew she was sick. And when she was out of it, she didn't know that she was sick and dying. And so it's, you want the person to be there and know you, but on the other hand, it's almost better if they don't, because the reality is not pretty.
You're listening to Writer's Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, a co-production with The Ohio Channel. You can learn more about Writer's Talk at www.writerstalk.org or facebook.com/writerstalk. And now, back to my discussion with NEA grant recipient and OSU graduate, Maggie Smith.
When you're, say, workshopping something like this,
how...
It seems like it must be really difficult to separate the comments that people are saying from what you've got invested in the poetry.
I think it is in general. I mean, it's probably like that with any genre, maybe more in poetry, but probably not. I mean, if you think about creative nonfiction and people are writing really personal things, and you have to listen to people say, I don't like the ending, or I don't understand what you're saying here. And I think that can be rough, but I mean, as when I taught creative writing and in my experiences teaching, my approach was always to remind the students that you're not being graded, or your students are not commenting on your feelings. So if I give this poem a B, it's not because I think your feelings are a B. And I'm not in any way diminishing the importance of this moment in your life. What I'm saying is the technique you're using and the way that you're communicating and expressing it isn't quite excellent yet, and it can be better. And so I think it's important, you know, in a creative writing workshop, and or if you're just emailing it to a friend and getting feedback, to sort of divorce that personal feeling and just remember that it's a piece of work that has to go out into the world, and you can't follow it. So you can't be there when someone's reading the Paris Review to say, no, 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 that's not what I meant. This is what I meant. It needs to be able to be self-contained. And if it's not, then it's your job to fix it.
Okay. Tell me more about being both a poet and a creative writing teacher. I know you did that for like a year.
Yeah.
And that's a common thing. You know, like you said, most
people do teach, yeah.
And how does that work for you? What is your approach when you're teaching creative writing?
Well, I mean, I think my approach was always to get them working as much as possible and to get as much down as possible, and then to really sort of moderate the workshop process. Because again, especially at the undergraduate level, you are, I think, more sensitive to criticism because you haven't necessarily established your voice yet. And so if 15 people come and have different feedback about a poem, you have to learn how to weed through those comments. And it may be that everyone, you know, five people say, I love the first line, do not change it. And five more people say, I like everything about this poem but the first line. And you obviously can't make both changes, and maybe you should make neither. You know, maybe you need to stick with your gut and say, and be prepared to defend your choice. But a lot of what I focused on when I was teaching was navigating that process, because it can be really hairy. I mean, it's one thing to spend time with a blank page and try to get the work down, but it's another thing to sit in a room full of people that you you know, care about their opinions and know socially, and it can be kind of awkward. And so a lot of my job was sort of moderating that mm-hmm. process.
And that seems like a particular, I mean, when I've taught more business writing, because yeah. I sort of strayed away from the idea of, I didn't want to be involved in the emotional lives necessarily of the students, because a lot of times it is really painful, and I felt like they're writing about very painful things, and I felt that like that, you know, you write something about the death of a parent, and then I have to give it a B because the technique isn't good.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons.
It opens up a can of worms.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'm also curious about, the workshop process always creates problems for me in the way that you're describing, you know, you get all these different comments, and then there's the teacher comment.
Right.
And then,
which tends to trump all of the students' comments, right?
Right. And then you say to the student, oh, but then go off and maybe you need to follow your gut. And there are got to be times when you go, well, you followed your gut, but your gut was wrong.
Your gut was wrong. I mean, can your gut be wrong? Probably not. But is the poem that you came up with by following your gut the poem that I would have written about this topic? No. But I think that's the tricky thing, too, is, you know, I write, you know, lyric free verse poetry that does not rhyme. So if I get a student in class who's writing rhyming poems, I can't rewrite that poem or give them comments to try to make them write a Maggie Smith poem. I have to kind of meet them where they are. And so part of that is just resigning yourself to the fact that your job is not to get all of your students' poems to look like your versions of them when they leave mm-hmm. class, and letting them, you know, write narrative poems or rhyming poems or haiku or whatever the case may be. And your job is just to teach them the tools, you know, imagery, metaphor, assonance, whatever their toolbox might be, to get them to write that poem the best that they can, and just leaving it at that.
Tell me about you said lyrical free verse poetry, no rhyming.
No rhyming.
You've never rhymed, so why not? I mean, it's a very common kind of poetry now, but what, you know, why have you written poetry that rhymes before and thought, there's something about this I don't like? Does it feels artificial? Why?
Well, I mean, I've written poems that rhymed when I had to. You know, if I had an assignment and it had to rhyme, I'm able to hear it, so I can actually write a poem that rhymes, but it doesn't, it's not naturally how I would express myself. So it always kind of feels like I'm trying to shoehorn it into a different form. I do have a poem in Lamp of the Body that's in iambic pentameter. So I have tried meter, and I actually enjoy writing in meter more than I enjoy writing in rhyme, because I think that to me is a little bit more natural. Mm-hmm. But rhyme, it wouldn't have occurred to me. I don't read a lot of rhyming poetry. I'm sort of in awe of it, and I admire it, because I think when it's done well, it's just amazing that people could choose words that seem like it's the only word that could have possibly gone there, and yet it rhymes. Mm-hmm. And when you had so many other choices that didn't, and yet it never, you know, good rhyming poetry, I feel, whenever you get to the word that rhymes, you aren't thinking, oh, well, I would have rather have had this word. It was a better choice, but obviously they fell back on the one that rhymes. Good rhyming poetry, it's as if that was the only choice.
Well, let's follow up on that. Who are the poets that you follow, that you really admire, either rhyming or non-rhyming? Who?
So many. I mean, I have more books than I can count, but If I think about the books that are usually on my bedside table that I like to read a couple poems before I go to sleep at night, James Wright is one of them. Becky and Fritz Goldberg, amazing poet, contemporary poet.
What do you find amazing about these two poems? What's poets specifically?
Mostly imagery between the two of them, I would say, is shared. Their work is very different, but both of them, imagery and metaphor, they're able to just make me see things in a way that I wish I had thought of it. Mm-hmm. And I think the best poems make you a little bit jealous. You know, when you read I got a really amazing book. Matthew Zapruder's new book is called Come On All You Ghosts. And I got it for Christmas this year. And I remember sitting down that day and just reading it cover to cover and being a little sad almost when I finished it, because I just thought that book was so amazing. And it's not at all the style that I write in, but wow, I wish I could do that.
Mm-hmm. So you got jealousy for Christmas.
Jealousy for Christmas. I probably deserve that for some karmic reason.
So with living poets, if you had the opportunity to talk to them, what sort of things would you ask them as a poet? What are the kinds of things, if you talk to that author, what would
that
you ask?
Yeah. Well, you know, I selfishly would probably want to show her some work and say, this isn't working for me, what would you do to it?
Okay.
If only she could turn on track changes and just show me with a couple of poems an example of how she gets to where she's at.
That's a surprisingly technological viewpoint
yeah.
from somebody who's into words, because that's usually they're more of a Luddite kind of
And I am. I don't actually type. I type with two fingers.
Okay.
And I only type poems when I feel like they've already taken shape and there's not much more I can do with them on paper. Like I really need to be able to test out line breaks and cut and paste.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I put things into the computer. But, you know, 99% of the process is on, you know, small sheets of notebook paper or on legal pads.
Okay. You don't worry about losing those all around the house.
Sometimes I do. And
yeah.
sometimes I'll actually come across a draft in my computer and I'll you know, see a title of a file and I'll open it and it's a poem I never remember writing. And I don't know how long it's been there. I don't remember typing it in.
Your husband or children aren't fooling with you, just putting things in.
You know, I don't think so. But
okay.
I do sometimes misplace things. And then sometimes it's a joy to discover them a year later and say, okay, is this still worth pursuing or not? Maybe I should lose it for another year and see what happens.
Okay. How many have you rescued like that have shown up in the things?
Not a lot of whole poems, but I rescue pieces all the time. I call them orphan lines. And if I have a line to a poem, I don't know what to do with it, but I just hear the line in my head, I'll write it in a notebook,
mm-hmm.
and I'll just collect them there. And if I'm working on something, I might just kind of go back to one of those notebooks and flip through and see if there's maybe a line or two that I've written down that just doesn't have a home yet that I can give a home to.
Okay. Well, with all the poetry that you've written, what's the literary form that you haven't tried that may be in your future? Is there a fiction book? Is there?
Oh no!
Nothing hiding.
I joke that my stories are prose poems where people sort of think to themselves in italics. I have never been good with plot. I spend a lot of time if I try to write in other genres describing the scenery and people's internal conflicts without really having things happen. So I don't know that fiction will ever come naturally to me. Nonfiction, I don't know. I mean, becoming a parent, I feel like there's a lot of things I want to write down, if only to remember what's
mm-hmm.
going on, but I'm not sure that that really has a wider audience than maybe me and my child.
I mean, you wrote about your grandmother.
Yeah.
Here, so it may be the next book, next two books are following your child.
Yeah, and I'm definitely finding writing, I'm not really writing motherhood poems, but I'm finding my daughter and sort of being a mom, it's working its way into my poems now in mm-hmm. a way that, you know, obviously it couldn't before, so.
That may lead to more children, adoption, things along those lines.
Or maybe just more poems.
More poems. I'm surprised there aren't more poems about laundry, since you...
Since I do so much of it while I'm working.
You several times have mentioned, you know, I do...
I do a lot of laundry.
That must be something you should pass on to other poets.
Yeah, I do more laundry than I write poems, but I wish it were the other way around.
Okay. Well, anyway, I thank you very much, Maggie Smith.
Thanks for having me.
Again, the books are Lamp of the Body and The List of Dangers. Also, the very difficult to get nesting dolls, which can be ordered online.
For more from my guest Maggie Smith, visit www.writerstalk.org. Or you can meet Maggie Smith at the May 7th Ohio Anna Book Festival, along with many other Ohio writers. The schedule of events is at www.ohioanna.org, and it includes last week's guest, Carrie Bebris, along with the mystery novelist Lisa Black, who claims to have spent the happiest years of her life in a morgue, Tim Bowers and J. Patrick Lewis, who produced the first dogs, White House Christmas, and Dan Boyd of the Don't Sweat the Small Stuff series. So whatever your interest, an Ohioan will be there with a book about it. That's May 7th on the Fort Hays campus. Check out ohioanna.org for more information. Writers Talk is a co-production of the Ohio Channel and the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University. Join me next time for guest interviewer OSU student Bria Heidelberg and her discussion with Margaret George, author of the historical fiction novel Elizabeth I, which should help those of you who might have otherwise gone into withdrawal from not enough information about the British royal family. Also, OSU student Derek Palacio reviews Daniel Evans's Before You Drown Your Own Fool Self. That's next time on Writer's Talk. Until then, this is Doug Dangler at The Ohio State University. Keep writing.